This is a Momentum Media production.
Investor Daily Uncut, your essential guide to the biggest news and headlines in financial services this week.
Hello there. Thank you once again for tuning in. It's David here from Investor Daily Uncut, and once again joined you today for a great another edition of our ESG Summit podcast series. So we're very excited to also have on today Shane Hurst. And Shane Hurst, you're the Managing Director and Senior Portfolio Manager for ClearBridge Investments. It's great, one, to know that you're going to be at the event itself, but two, really good to get some time with you today. How are you going?
Good, David. Good. Thank you.
No, good stuff, mate. I think we've got, we haven't really discussed too much personally, but I wanted to run through a series of questions with you pretty much around the event itself. So for anyone that didn't get a chance to see you at the event, or maybe they have, the whole design of this, I guess, is for you out there listening to get a bit more of an idea, I guess, in terms of where we're coming at, where ClearBridge is stationed for the ESG environment, but also as well, just a bit more of an idea in terms of and some depth around that session that we're covering. So Shane, without further ado, the first question I wanted to jump into really was, how do infrastructure and utility assets benefit from a move towards net zero? It's a big question to answer.
Look, it absolutely is, David. And look, infrastructure and utilities are absolutely at the forefront of that move towards net zero. With spending captured in asset bases, returns on equity earned off those asset bases, really the opportunity is substantial for infrastructure and utilities. Just giving you an idea of how big it really is, there's US $36 trillion of spending expected to 2050, with roughly $16 trillion invested in global transmission globally. So, really what that means is you have $36 trillion wrapped into asset bases. We earn a return off it as an infrastructure and utility investor. And importantly, it's really been accelerated over the next 8 years to even come close to being on track towards net zero. There's a number of things that need to happen. There's an electrification of the grid, really a lesser reliance on coal, oil, and really even gas, frankly. Substantial annual power spending. So we're talking $2.5 trillion per annum in all areas of the power grid. Massive ramp up in renewable spend. So almost five times the amount of renewables on this planet needed over the next 8 years. In 2030, decarbonizing transport. So again, the greater use of electric vehicles, lower carbon fuels will be accelerated over the coming years. So, it is a multi-decade tailwind for infrastructure and utilities, and infrastructure utilities very much are at the forefront of decarbonization, David.
It's interesting you mentioned that. And of course, these are very large numbers, but I guess with that in respect, there's a massive project that needs to go underway here as well. And I know that, in the global scheme of things, Australia is not the leading forefront runner in terms of where we sit just yet. And that's nothing to be ashamed of. It's great that we actually have this kind of, I guess, level of assets then being changed or at least adapted to actually benefit this space as we move forward. It's going to take a lot of work.
Absolutely. To your point, while Australia isn't at the forefront and has a huge reliance on coal and natural resources, obviously a large amount of exports and a large amount of the economy, you are starting to see some new initiatives evolve. You have hydrogen hubs, you have greater rollout of renewables, greater amount of private money being committed. So, look, I think Australia is blessed with an abundance of sunshine, and certainly in some parts of the country, huge amounts of wind. And so on that basis, just as long as we can get that electricity to other parts of the country in a sensible way, Australia should be relatively well placed to achieve net zero.
Yeah, I agree as well. I think the interesting thing is Australia is in a very unique position also, you could say, given that the fact that there is a little bit of a curve to get over and of course have that trajectory move forward. It does give us the opportunity to learn from what other countries have done, even though we have our own kind of infrastructure, as we know. But it's amazing to be able to use that as case studies for our way forward, correct?
Absolutely. No, absolutely, David.
The next question I wanted to ask as well, Shane, look, it's relatively on the same path of this, but I wanted to understand a little bit more about how infrastructure protects investors from high inflation environments. We've learned a lot over the last few months around inflation and how that's going to impact our world. But on more of a domestic, and I guess also we could talk potentially global scale here as well, where that sits and how that is kind of projected or protected into investors' worlds.
Yeah, look, and that's a great question. Taking a step back, our internal view on inflation is, whilst there have been a number of structural elements of inflation, you know, shelter, wages have clearly started to kick back up, you know, especially in areas like the US in particular, there are also a number of cyclical elements. So, you know, there's been a bring forward or a brought forward of product type demand. There's been issues with seizing up of supply chains as a result of COVID. So, look, there have been a lot of things happening in pricing. And as a result of that, it's difficult to get a clear path forward for inflation. I would say our internal view is that inflation will moderate over the 12 months. But let's take a step back and really think about the impact for infrastructure. And I mean, you think about infrastructure, there really is a pre-programming of inflation into infrastructure assets. And what does that mean? Well, it means for GDP sensitive assets such as road, rail, and airports, you actually get an adjustment of your revenues as inflation increases, and similarly adjustments as inflation decreases. When you look at utilities, there's an adjustment to the asset base or an adjustment to tariffs or tolls of that utility as you get movements up and down in inflation. So on a standalone basis, when you see inflation increase for a utility or an infrastructure asset, what you really see is revenues increase in lockstep. Obviously, that's not the whole picture, David. You know, as we all know, wages also increase, other costs such as energy increase, and so do financing costs increase. So net-net, the impact from rising inflation on cash flows tends to be a neutral to slightly positive. When you look at it from a valuation standpoint, because you do get higher inflation in bond yields, tends to be neutral for inflation as it relates to infrastructure and utility assets. Now, as a bottom-up manager and a manager that's an active investor, we have ways to manage the portfolio through cycles. And certainly what that means is at the start of the cycle, we will tend to own more transport and energy infrastructure assets. They're those assets that benefit from higher growth, higher inflation, and larger amounts in the portfolio. And then as we move through the cycle and towards the end of the cycle, we'll start to rotate more into utilities, which will benefit from a slowing of growth and a slowing of inflation. So we do have a way to handle that through both portfolio construction and also looking at the constructs around infrastructure and utility assets.
Thanks, Shane. No, it's really good. It's good to sort of get the overall, I guess, bird's eye view in terms of where that sits. It's always really interesting when you talk around infrastructure. We're talking around an awful lot of things, that moving parts that happen. So it's good to, I guess, break this down as a real clear bird's eye view on that. Thank you. And also as well, like, what is climate inflation? This is also kind of linked to it before, but I want to know how that would impact, say, for example, energy bills. And I guess, what can utilities do to mitigate those impacts as well?
Yeah, look, climate inflation is an interesting one and really not that well understood out there in the market. So, you know, put simply, climate inflation is a cost impost of an energy transition or the move towards a decarbonized world. So what does that mean in a nutshell? Well, there's a couple of factors that impact climate inflation. Firstly, higher energy costs, and higher energy costs often come, as we've seen, from an underinvestment in fossil fuels around the world currently. You've seen what's happening in Russia and the Ukraine. That's obviously put upward pressure on energy prices. And so what that means is that would lead to a higher amount of inflation in the hands of consumers. That's obviously not it. Climate inflation also includes the investment into renewables, the investment to decarbonize grids, and as a result of that, the need to recover that from ratepayers. So that capital spend needs to be recovered by a utility and infrastructure name, and so they recover it from consumers. I guess the final point is, if you think about the way the world's evolving, electrification is really what's happening over the next 20 to 30 years. So, you know, traditional fuel sources like gas, coal, and oil are being used less. And in fact, what's happening is we're trying to electrify grids with very sustainable forms of generation. As a result of that, electricity demand will actually increase as a percentage of energy from roughly 25% to roughly 50% by 2050. And so as a result of that, that will also put pressure on, upward pressure on inflation. So whilst that sounds somewhat bleak, certainly that's not the end of the world. And utilities do have a number of ways to mitigate that. And we've seen that historically, and we'll see that into the future. firstly, cost controls, so the ability to control their costs through a cycle, all different types of costs, whether it's labour, whether it's equipment and material costs that's sold. They really have the ability to do that and have been able to do that. Scale buying, so the ability to buy goods on a larger scale has also reduced costs. And we've seen subsidies put in place by governments around the world, by states around the world. What that means is a lesser cost to consumers. And then finally, and you're seeing this certainly in places like Europe, the ability to streamline policy on carbon pricing such that you don't overly impact lower socioeconomic groups. And that's really crucial. And you've seen utilities actually do that really, really well.
Yeah, absolutely, Shane. And I think it's interesting on the points you raised as well there. A lot of that comes from, I guess, the innovation or development of those assets as well. For example, I remember the times when solar energy was just not feasible because the cells that were used to be able to capture the energy from it just weren't cost effective. And I think, you know, as we move forward into a much more sustainably minded world, we do also have to agree that there's technology on our side as well that's also bringing down those costs too, which I guess will have an impact, right?
Absolutely. And look, that's something we may talk about a little bit later, but you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at the cost of solar panels, they've fallen 80% over the last 12 years. If you look at onshore wind, the cost of equipment for onshore wind's fallen about 40-odd percent. So, you know, there's been a big decrease in cost, but it's not only the cost, it's also utilization. So you've been able to improve your solar panels, improve the way your wind farms capture wind. The use of batteries is another way to kind of store energy. So, you know, clearly greater investment, greater time spent thinking about a cleaner future leads to the ability to deploy renewables in a much more cost-effective, economic and sustainable way.
Yeah, absolutely, Shane. And I think segueing nicely into a similar question on this as well, what we just discussed was, you know, what has changed over those last few years for investors? I know a lot of investors and advisors are quite keen to understand, you know, is now the right time to benefit from the move towards net zero?
Yeah, look, I think the answer is yes. And there's a number of things that have changed. I think, you know, there are three key things. Firstly, policy support is the first one. So, you know, when you think about COP26 in terms of global policy support, to start off with, COP26 happened end of last year. 109 countries pledging to slash emissions, developing countries such as India committing to net zero targets. You've seen the phasing down and phasing out of coal. Deforestation, obviously, there's a commitment to halting deforestation. So, you know, there's been global initiatives that have been far further reaching than we've seen in the past. Regionally, you're seeing countries, and you mentioned previously, and regions such as Europe, committing to far more aggressive targets. And you know, what I'm really thinking about is the 55, which is a commitment to reduce emissions by 55% by 2030. Obviously, that's now become slightly more aggressive post the goings-on in Ukraine and Russia. But certainly there's been a very strong policy commitment in the European region to reduce carbon emissions. You've also seen that in regions like North America and in particular the US over the last 12 to 18 months. As we talked about earlier, Australia is also putting forward commitment, and you've seen a pledge towards net zero by 2050. You've also seen $20 billion set aside for investment in low emissions technologies over the next 20 years. So policy support is one crucial differentiator. As we just talked about, falling costs of equipment and improving efficiency is a massive difference. As we talked about previously, there's been substantial decreases in the cost of equipment. Solar's fallen 80-odd percent. Over the last 12 years, you've seen wind equipment fall 40% onshore, offshore wind more like 30%. You've also seen substantial amounts of improvement in terms of the way these assets actually capture the natural resource. Battery deployment has been crucial. And, you know, when you speak to the companies that we speak to, what they're actually doing is they're rolling out solar with battery all the time so they can maximize the amount of generation they can store and in fact capture through every part of the day. So that's the second point. The third point is clearly there is a groundswell of support for climate change. In 2019, we saw the largest amount of climate change protests around the world. So you had 185 countries where there were climate change protests. There is really a groundswell for climate change. So that's kind of why now, I guess importantly to us, is how does it benefit our investments? You know, we've talked about these before, but two key reasons. Utilities and infrastructure are at the forefront of decarbonisation. They invest in these assets. They get captured in asset bases. They earn a very safe, stable cash flow and dividend and return off that investment. So it is really a very safe way to play the move towards decarbonisation. Secondly, this is not an investment cycle that's going to take 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. This is a 30-plus year tailwind. And so as a result of that, you're going to see enhanced capital spend. You're going to see very attractive returns, attractive cash flows earned over a number of years. And so we think it's a fantastic time to invest for the move towards decarbonisation. And we honestly think the safest way to do that is through infrastructure and utilities.
Absolutely. It's amazing to see the level of, I guess, eagerness or education that's being learned from the general public and experts out there that are in the energy space, for example. It's amazing to really, when you put it into context, you know, there's so much more. We've never had more of an emotional factor come towards our energy, or at least how we use energy across. And to get to net zero, it's not just a goal. It's more of a, I guess, now a habit, and also something which is being transitioned as a way of life. You know, we have got many different reasons for doing it, but there's so many different types of energy or outlets out there which we've got, which have been innovated rather than your standard fossil fuels. It's incredible to see that grow already. To think that we have years and years coming ahead, you can just imagine the amount of innovation that's going to come from that space again.
Honestly, look, and frankly, it is incredible, you know, the speed these things have evolved and will evolve with some proper investment in them. So, you know, hydrogen is one where, you know, we are expecting kind of green hydrogen to become more prevalent in the 2030s onwards. But, and sorry, green hydrogen for all the viewers is really using renewable energy to create hydrogen in the most carbon-friendly way. But there's no doubt, you know, technology cycles seem to surprise on the upside. And so, you know, it could be the end of this decade where we see huge amounts of green hydrogen produced. As a result of that, you know, we could actually start to approach a greener world far, far quicker than 2050 if that technology cycle really takes hold.
Absolutely. Shane, really keen actually, just to, before we wrap this up as well, my last question really is just to sort of look under the hood a little bit within ClearBridge Investments portfolio. And I wanted to understand a few examples of companies that are in that portfolio, but also, you know, the ones that will exactly benefit from that move towards net zero.
Yeah. So look, let me look at three, David. I mean, the first one is EDP. EDP is a Portuguese utility, current holding in both funds, both key funds of ours. Currently, they have 12 gigawatts of current installed wind and solar generation, which is a substantial amount. Interestingly, under our base case, they will have to spend three times their enterprise value, or 111 billion euro, towards over the next 30 years to even hit that base case. Now, that's not a net zero outcome. To hit a net zero outcome, they actually have to spend more like 180 billion euro, which is more like five times their current enterprise value. So that will see their, if they were to hit a net zero outcome by 2050, that would see the amount of gigawatts under ownership go from 12 gigawatts to 88 gigawatts. So seven times current greater capacity. So a huge amount of investment. And that's not even taking into account what they have to spend on their distribution or transmission regulated grids. So, you know, EDP is one great example in Portugal. CMS Energy, $17 billion US utility. They have both gas and electric utility. They service about 7 million people in Michigan in the US. So they recently submitted an integrated resource plan. An integrated resource plan really is a long-term planning document that agrees capital expenditure or capital spend over a period of time. In this case, it's over the next 6 years. And, you know, essentially what this plan says is they will spend a fair amount of money mostly on renewables build, so to build 2.6 gigawatts of renewables. They'll exit coal by 2025, and they'll also have a substantial bill saving, so $700 million US dollars of savings in the bill. The plan itself will reduce carbon by 60% by 2025 from a 2005 baseline. So, you know, really carbon efficient plan. In addition to that, they will see their asset base growth go from 6.8% per annum over the last 7 or 8 years to 8% per annum over the next 6 years. So a big step up in capital growth, and certainly in a way that controls for rates and for climate inflation, as we talked about. Finally, and the really the last example I want to talk about is the largest owner of wind and solar and developer of wind and solar in the US. They're called NextEra Group. They're listed. The biggest utility in the US is owned by NextEra Group. 30 gigawatts of renewables generation capacity currently. So NextEra will certainly benefit from the move towards decarbonisation. They're expected to increase their renewables and solar capacity by 50% over the next 3 years. That's 50. They have significant economies of scale, which gives them a massive competitive advantage. And importantly, they are best in class in terms of affordability to customers. So that's crucial when it comes to utilities and infrastructure. And really that social license to operate is the ability to spend capital, but also keep customers happy in that final step of when customers get their bill. So just to reiterate, David, you know, with such a large amount of spend needed to decarbonize the planet over the coming decades, you know, infrastructure and utilities really will benefit quite substantially. They are certainly at the forefront of decarbonizing this planet. And, you know, from our perspective, we see a number of opportunities around the world to take advantage of that in listed markets.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing as well there, Shane, it's great to hear some of the companies that you're exposed into, not just large by number, but large in terms of their commitment by capital as well, which is just a big, ticking a lot of people's boxes in, as well, I would imagine. Shane, look, that's all we, unfortunately, that is all we have time for. We can talk about this a lot, as I'm sure you can imagine. But I was actually really impressed by different types of scenarios and questions that I was actually able to throw at you. And thank you so much for your time answering really clearly and collectively.
Thank you very much, David.
And to you out there, thank you so much for listening into this special episode for the ESG Summit. We will continue this series across. We still have a whole host of partners and panels available for you as well into this podcast series. If you did get a chance to meet ClearBridge at the ESG Summit, that's brilliant. If you didn't get a chance, no worries, because you can also mention and actually get a chance to look at their content across on the Investor Daily Knowledge Center. Or if you did enjoy this podcast, we always want to hear your feedback. It's editor@investordaily.com.au. Until then, I'll see you in the next episode and appreciate your time. Thank you.